5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
This is the new Weight Watchers, built for real life and real results, no matter what mode you're in. Maddie went all in for her big day and lost 33 pounds. Emily lost 85 pounds and hit her goal while still living her life.
Weight Watchers gave me the tools and I feel amazing.
Join the millions of members and lose weight with the number one doctor-recommended weight loss program.
I'm able to live my life and still hit my goals.
Lose more at WeightWatchers.com.
Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast is adapted from my YouTube channel, and this episode is part of my Vault series, where I'm turning my back catalogue into podcasts. So, if I ever reference photos or things on screen, please remember that these episodes were originally made for video. Also, if research or references seem out of date, please bear in mind as well that some of these episodes were recorded as far back as 2016. I just want to make sure that all of my content is available on podcast as well for you to enjoy. If you wish to find me on YouTube, I am just Georgia Marie over there, and with all my disclaimers out of the way, enjoy the episode. Now, I know you guys like it when I do the really unheard of, unknown cases, and I love doing them too, that's why I mostly cover them. But this week's case, you probably have heard of. Occasionally, a more popular case will catch my eye, and I just spend weeks and weeks researching.
Want to feel more confident with your finances this year? If you have 60 seconds, I can show you how quick and easy it is to start building healthy money habits that could last you the entire year just by using Rocket Money. Step 1, download Rocket Money. Step 2, link all your accounts and see your entire spending picture, your subscriptions, your upcoming bills, your due dates, everything. Step 3, tap a subscription you don't use and cancel it. Boom! That's money back every single month. Step 4, create a financial goal for something you want to save for, whether it be a vacation, a retirement account, or a pet's birthday. We don't judge. Now let the app automatically move small amounts of cash towards your goal. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you saved. Similar to the over 10 million members on the app that have saved up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Use the savings challenge as one step closer to feeling better about your finances today at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. One more time, it's rocketmoney.com/cancel.
This is the new Weight Watchers, built for real life and real results, no matter what mode you're in. Maddie went all in for her big day and lost 33 pounds. Emily lost 85 pounds and hit her goal while still living her life.
Weight Watchers gave me the tools and I feel amazing.
Join the millions of members and lose weight with the number one doctor-recommended weight loss program.
I'm able to live my life and still hit my goals.
Lose more at WeightWatchers.com.
Until I just have to do a video on it. So this week we're covering the Tylenol murders. Even if you have heard about this case before, you've watched other videos on it, I would recommend you watch this one as well because I think I've gone into like a bit more detail than others. So it was late September 1982 when seven people in the Chicago and surrounding areas in Illinois died from cyanide poisoning. Someone had been tampering with drugstore pain medication. In this case, it was Tylenol. Seven people died in total from the Tylenol tampering, but it also led to a kind of domino effect of hundreds of other copycat killings across America. So you could argue that even more people died because of this.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
This is the new Weight Watchers. It works for members like JoJo, who's learning simple, healthy habits. Sharia, who's making progress with meds. And Kim, who still gets to eat what she loves. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now, it's your turn. Watch your life open up. Watch your story shift. Watch what you're capable of. Watch it work. Get started today at WeightWatchers.com.
I really understand what happened here. I need to give you a bit of context as to what drugstore medication was like in the 1980s or early 1980s. Because this particular incident led to a complete overhaul in how pharmaceutical companies package their drugs, and that is how we know them to be today. So I've travelled to America a lot in my lifetime, and I can say without a doubt there's a big difference in how drugs are packaged just between the US and the UK. Just when I went to America earlier this year in February on a family holiday, we all got the flu, it was a big thing. We spent a lot of time in Walgreens and other pharmacies. So something that I have noticed is in the UK, most drugs come in sort of boxes with the drugs and sort of, wait, I've got some here to show you. Kind of like this. Obviously you get stuff like that.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
In the US as well, but in the UK, it's pretty much all like that. In the US, you get them in bottles mostly, and in the UK, you don't really ever come across drugs coming in bottles. So just a little bit of context from UK viewers that aren't entirely sure what I'm talking about. Actually, over here, when you get pills in bottles, it's mostly vitamins and things like that. But as a general rule over here, when it comes in that sort of like plastic blister packaging with a foil over the top, and it comes with strict instructions not to touch the drugs inside if the foil has been tampered with. Same in America, the bottles come with strict instructions not to touch the drugs inside if the foil on top of the bottle has been tampered with. And it's not only now that there's the foil and the instructions not to touch it, that even the lids on the bottles are harder to get into. Back in the early 1980s, this wasn't the case. It was literally just a regular bottle, you could open it, there was some cotton inside, and then the drugs. Anybody could easily open it, tamper with the drugs, put the lid back on, and place it back on the store shelves. Also nowadays, most drugs come in pill form. So even if people try to tamper with these, it's quite difficult to do so because they're just solid pills. Whereas these pills that were tampered with back in 1982 were capsules. Now in the UK, the only time you ever get capsules nowadays is when it's an NHS prescription and you have to go into the pharmacy to pick up your prescription. I've had acne medication and other medications that have come like this, but never ever off of the store shelves. If you don't know the capsule form that I'm talking about, we're basically talking about two gelatine shells, and you can sort of like easily pull them apart, and inside the two shells is the drug in powder form. A lot of people preferred this method of pain medication or antibiotics back in the day because it absorbed so much faster into the bloodstream. But it also meant they could easily be tampered with, as is what happened in Chicago in the 1980s. The first death happened on September 29th, 1982. 12-year-old Mary Kellerman wakes up at dawn with sort of cold-like symptoms. She has a sore throat and runny nose and goes into her parents' room. Now, her parents give her a couple of pills of extra strength Tylenol and they send her back to bed. They wake up at 7 a.m. the next morning to find Mary lying on the floor of the bathroom, barely breathing. They rush her to hospital, but sadly she's pronounced dead at 10 a.m. Now, as strange as it was for a healthy 12-year-old girl just to drop dead, the doctors didn't think it was anything suspicious at this point. They just assumed she'd had a stroke. However, just later that same day, 27-year-old Adam Janus has shoulder pain, so he takes a couple of Tylenol pills and lies down. A few minutes later, his wife Teresa wants to speak to him about something, so goes over to get his attention and notice that he's not moving, he's barely breathing, and she cannot wake him up. When the paramedics arrived, he was alive but in a deep, deep coma. He was completely unresponsive, and they managed to keep his heart going manually until he arrived at the hospital. Now, the man who dealt with Adam once he was in hospital was a man called Dr. Thomas Kim, and he later said that it was so strange for a healthy 27-year-old man to arrive in hospital and they couldn't keep him alive. I mean, with modern technology, and I'm talking modern for the 1980s, he said it was so rare for somebody to not be able to be kept alive by hospital technology, and they just couldn't keep him breathing. Adam had 8 members of his family standing around his hospital bed grieving for him. Later on, they all go back to Adam's house. They don't go back to their individual houses. They want to be with Adam's wife. In their grief, the entire family took pain medication. The older 6 all took aspirin, but the younger 2 settled for Tylenol, the same Tylenol capsules that Adam had taken earlier that day. These 2 were Adam's younger brother, Stanley Janus, he was 25 years old, and his wife, 19-year-old Teresa. The family soon realised that something was wrong with them as well, and so they were rushed back to hospital. The hospital kept the 2 on life support, but Stanley died the next day and Teresa's life support was turned off 2 days later on October 1st. Stanley and Teresa ended up back at the same hospital that Adam had died at earlier in the day, and just by pure luck, the doctor who was in charge of their care was the same doctor who was in charge of Adam, so he immediately realised there must be a common denominator in their deaths. But poisoning didn't even cross his mind. He assumed it was something they ate, or maybe carbon monoxide. It was a lucky coincidence that all 3 of these ended up in Dr. Kim's care. If Stanley and Teresa had ended up going to a different hospital, then people wouldn't have made the link to the Tylenol so quickly, and many more people would have died. A nurse called Helen Jensen was the first one to make the possible link to the Tylenol. Dr. Kim sent her and some others to the Janus house just to have a look around and see if there was anything that could be suspect. It was Helen Jensen who realised that there were only 6 pills missing from the Tylenol bottle, and so she picks up, along with a load of other suspect materials, and takes it back to Dr. Kim at the hospital. Now, Dr. Kim sits at his desk with all of this stuff from the Janus house in front of him, and he's sort of looking at it all in detail. He pours out some of the Tylenol capsules into his hand, smells them, and notices nothing weird. He did note at the time that this was the only thing that all 3 of the Januses had consumed, and he knew that the symptoms were completely wrong for a standard overdose. At this point, he calls the Cook County Medical Examiner and tells them to look into the Tylenol capsules. At this point, he is thinking poison, and cyanide crosses his mind for the first time. Now, at this point, an investigator comes to look at the capsules and he pours them out into his hand and he smells them, and what he smells is almonds. Now, cyanide smells strongly of almonds, but it's something that only 50% of the population could pick up on. So they just got very lucky that this investigator was the one who came to look at this case, and the others may not have been able to smell it straight away. The authorities were, of course, contacted immediately, and at this point, the connection to Mary Kellerman's death was also made. So they tested the blood of all four victims, and sure enough, it came back with high levels of cyanide. I mean, I'm talking several times the lethal dose. The Tylenol bottle from the Kellerman's house was tested alongside the one from the Janice house, and it was confirmed that these contained cyanide. And it was actually 65 milligrams of cyanide, which is 10,000 times the lethal dose. That same day, while doctors were working hard to keep Adam Janice alive, a woman called Mary Rayner takes a Tylenol capsule. She'd given birth to a fourth child a week beforehand and just wasn't feeling great, so take some Tylenol. That very same day, still September 29th, Mary McFarland is at work in a store and she complains of a bad headache, so she goes into the back room of the store to take some Tylenol. Within minutes, she's on the ground. Both were rushed to different hospitals, but they were pronounced dead the next day. Paula Prince was a flight attendant and she lands at Chicago O'Hare Airport late that evening. On the way back to her flat, she stops at Walgreens and picks up a bottle of Tylenol. The body is discovered by police 2 days later at 5 p.m. on Friday the 1st of October. She'd failed to meet her sister for dinner the previous day and wasn't answering her phone, and she also failed to turn up to a flight, and so the police were contacted. When the police arrived, the open bottle of Tylenol was still sat on her vanity, and it's clear that she'd taken the Tylenol and attempted to walk to the bathroom, but hadn't even made it. She just collapsed while she was walking there. Cyanide kills people quickly and effectively. It's a chemical asphyxiant, and basically what it does is it stops the red blood cells from picking up oxygen. You could be in the most oxygen-rich atmosphere in the entire world, but if you've taken cyanide, then your red blood cells just aren't going to pick it up. So basically your body asphyxiates, it leads to brain damage and cardiac arrest, and it happens so quickly. So Dr. Kim received confirmation that it was the cyanide at 1 a.m. on Thursday, September 30th, 1982. So less than 24 hours, and they know that the cause of death is cyanide and they know where it's come from. I mean, it's such a lucky coincidence that things happened the way they did. Of course, it's not lucky that people died, but if they hadn't discovered this so quickly, so many more people would have died. By 10 a.m, an attorney for Johnson & Johnson, the parent company of Tylenol, is meeting with the district's medical examiner. They discuss all the facts and they know there's no way that they can keep this from the public. It is a matter of public safety and they have to let people know. I mean, for Johnson & Johnson, this was going to be an absolute PR nightmare as well as a financial nightmare. So there's a press conference and they tell the public about the cyanide and they say that if anybody has any Tylenol capsules, they are not to be touched. I mean, back in 1982, they didn't have social media, so news wouldn't have spread as fast as it does nowadays. But luckily, after this, nobody did touch their Tylenol and nobody else was poisoned. I mean, police even went down streets with a bullhorn shouting into it, "Nobody touch your Tylenol." But nurse Helen Jensen, the one who first made the connection to the Tylenol, wasn't satisfied with this at all. She calls the police herself and speaks to the deputy chief and tells him that the Tylenol needs to be taken off the shelves, and it needs to be taken off the shelves now. And luckily, the deputy chief completely agrees. By 3 p.m, Johnson & Johnson announced that all Tylenol from the specific lots from which this batch had come from would be removed from the shelves. However, by 11 p.m. that same day, and they discovered the body of Paula Prince, they actually announced that all Tylenol was being recalled. No store in the Chicago area was going to be selling it. Days later, October 5th, Johnson & Johnson actually removed all Tylenol nationwide. They recalled over 31 million bottles of Tylenol, and in the process, they lost over $100 million. But this was a case of public safety, and they actually dealt with it in a very good way. A lot of other companies probably wouldn't have done what they did. They knew they'd be taking a massive financial hit, but it wasn't worth it. They even offered to exchange anyone's Tylenol capsules for the solid pills. I mean, you can imagine at this point the frenzy that people went into. People were absolutely terrified. Police and the hospitals were inundated with calls from the public saying, "I've taken Tylenol, am I gonna die?" And the basic advice that people were giving out was, if you can take the Tylenol and you are still talking on the phone to us right now, you haven't been affected. I mean, cyanide works so quick that you would not have a chance to pick up that phone. On October 4th, Chicago City Council actually passes an ordinance that required all drugs to have tamper-proof packaging. I mean, it's crazy to think that before this, tamper-proof packaging wasn't a thing, but now it's just common sense. But before this happened, it just didn't cross people's minds. At this point, obviously, all of the authorities are well into the investigation, and I'm not just talking Chicago City Police, I'm talking FBI level. This was huge. It was a really tricky investigation though, because they had the murder weapon, they knew exactly what the murder weapon was, they knew how it worked, they knew where people got it from, but there was no way of tracing it back to a particular person. At the time, they found no fingerprints on the bottle, even though years later they did find one very smudged fingerprint. And also, the victims were completely random. There was no rhyme or reason to this. And this made the killer even more worrying, because they didn't care who they killed. It was just a case of them wanting to kill people, not caring who. There was no personal vendetta against the individual people there, so that made it even harder to trace, because usually in murders, there is a personal reason why somebody's been killed, making it easy to trace back and find the person who did it. But in this case, nothing. None of the victims were connected in any way. I mean, nowadays they refer to it as the first case of USA domestic terrorism, but they'd never had anything like this before. The authorities first assumed that the pills were tampered with at a factory level. It was an employee of Johnson & Johnson that were doing this. So they interviewed tons of employees, ex-employees, and they just didn't really get anywhere. I mean, the really worrying thing was they were interviewing people who clearly had nothing to do with it, but they had such big grudges against the company that they probably would have done if they thought of it. They soon realised though that this wasn't the case, and it wasn't factory level tampering. Each of these came from different batches, it wasn't the same factory or production plant. These had to be tampered with at store level. Somebody was literally walking into drugstores, picking Tylenol up off the shelves, taking them home, filling the capsules with cyanide, and then placing them back on the shelves. And you knew that it wasn't a case of just randomly taking bottles and randomly putting them back, because they all had batch numbers, they all like corresponded with the store they were at. This was very, very calculated. After all the Tylenol capsules were recalled, they also found three other bottles that had been contaminated. Like I said earlier, new DNA technology has led to them finding a smudged fingerprint on one of the bottles, but it's not very clear. They can't really do anything with it, and it's led to no new leads. So Wednesday, October the 6th, a letter arrives at Johnson & Johnson from somebody demanding $1 million to stop the Tylenol killings. Now, this letter was soon traced back to a guy called James W. Lewis, and they found him through his fingerprints that had been left on the letter. He basically said in the letter that the money was to be transferred to a particular bank account. Now, this bank account was actually non-active, and it belonged to James Lewis's wife's former employer. Now, from what I could gather, the employer had messed around James's wife Leanne a little bit, and he owed her money, and James basically decided it was a good idea to send an extortion letter to Johnson & Johnson to put £1 million into this bank account to frame, I can only assume, his wife's former employer. Of course, it completely backfired on him. In court, his defense argued that it wasn't extortion because he never actually intended to have the money himself, but regardless, he had a long criminal history and the judge saw right through him. The United States attorney overseeing the case said, "The grief and horror of September and October of 1982 is what he trafficked upon to commit his crime. This fear he used was the means by which he sought to achieve his ends. They said he was insensitive to human suffering." A jury of 8 men and 4 women deliberated for 3 hours before reaching a guilty verdict. Lewis was found guilty of extortion, and he was sentenced to a maximum of 20 years in jail and a $10,000 fine. In the end, he was released in 1995 after serving 13 years. Now, it sounds like Lewis was just guilty of sending the extortion letter, but for a lot of people, Lewis is guilty of the entire crime. They say that he is the one who committed the Tylenol murders. Most authorities maintain that Lewis was just an opportunist, saw an opportunity for some money or to frame his wife's employer, and so he took it. And they say that although he was clearly a disturbed man, he wasn't the one who did the killings. But there were also just as many people who believe that Lewis was the one who committed these murders. But at the end of the day, there is zero evidence to link him to it. Obviously, he wrote the letter, there's no denying that. But when it comes to linking him to the actual murders, they never found anything. They completely searched his house multiple times, never found any trace of cyanide. They just didn't really know how to link him to it. But I do think that's why he received such a lengthy sentence. I mean, there are murderers out there who receive less than 20 years, in the end he only served 13, but People serve less than that for full cold-blooded murder. I think the authorities were so desperate to find somebody for the murders and to pin it on somebody that Lewis got such a lengthy sentence. I mean, I can only assume it was kind of their way of being like, okay, we can't get him on the murders, but we'll give him a very heavy charge for the letter. Lewis did have a lot of criminal behaviour in his past. This wasn't a standard man. He was clearly very disturbed. Growing up, he was always incredibly violent towards his parents and a lot of other people around him. There were accusations of him killing a 72-year-old man called Raymond West after his fingerprints were found at the scene, but he was never charged with this. He was also a fugitive after tax fraud schemes in Missouri, and he had so many fake aliases. He had at least 16 fake identities that he used on a regular basis, and his wife had 4 of her own. When he was younger, he spent time in a mental hospital where he was treated for schizophrenia. And at one point, he briefly was a partner to a pharmacist. They kind of worked together, and this pharmacist taught Lewis how to make pills in capsules. It was very obvious that he was a violent man. He was very disturbed. He kind of fancied himself a criminal mastermind. He would constantly brag about all the money he was going to make and the schemes he was going to put on. And he was just a criminal. Whether he was guilty of the Tylenol murders, we'll probably never know. He was definitely capable of pulling off the murders. There's no doubt about that, but there's zero evidence. And one thing that I kind of question is that if he's stupid enough to send a letter to the police and leave it covered in fingerprints that were easily traced back to him, could he really have pulled off the Tylenol murders and not left any fingerprints? The police said that it's likely that the extortion was actually planned for over a year, but was he just waiting for an opportunity to sort of do the extortion, send a letter to somebody for $1 million? Or did he get bored of waiting and tamper the Tylenol himself so he would have a reason to do the extortion? Another suspect in this case is the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski. He was an American domestic terrorist and a very, very smart man. He was considered a mathematics prodigy. He went to university when he was 16 years old, and I think it was Harvard he went to. He ended up graduating. He became a professor at the university, and then he just kind of went off the grid. He quit his job, he moved to a remote cabin in the middle of the woods, no electricity, no running water, and he just cut himself off from society. Between 1978 and 1995, he would kill 3 people by sending bombs, homemade bombs, through the post. Not only did he kill 3 people, but he also injured 23 more. He would mail or hand deliver increasingly sophisticated bombs, never leaving any fingerprints, but he would leave very misleading, purposely misleading clues within the bombs. Kaczynski had a very anti-government, anti-technology sort of philosophy, so he would very much target those involved in modern technology. He was eventually caught in 1995 after he sent a 35,000 word manifesto to the media and told them to print it, otherwise he was going to bomb a plane. However, his sister-in-law recognised the letter as being something that Ted would most likely write, and so she goes to the FBI and they catch him. He was convicted in January 1998 and was given life in prison. Now, Ted Kaczynski was never looked at as a serious suspect in the Tylenol murders until 2011, when the FBI really started to look into him. They requested DNA from him in prison. I think they were trying to link him to the Tylenol bottles, but it's quite clear they never did because they never sort of progressed this any further. Ted has himself stated that he's innocent, saying that he has never possessed potassium cyanide. Now, he is in prison for life already. If he did it, would he probably just admit it? I don't know. A lot of these kind of people, serial killers, like to have that power over people, and therefore they probably won't admit this. But then at the same time, you kind of think, you're already in prison for life, like, just admit it. So I still don't know in this case. There are multiple things that do possibly link Ted to the Tylenol murders. First thing being that Ted's parents lived in Chicago, and since the murders, people have actually made maps, and Ted's parents' house was literally smack bang in the middle of where all of the drugstores with the tampered Tylenol were. And although we can't 100% confirm it, it's very, very likely that around the time of the murders, Ted was actually staying with his parents. Ted also had a signature when he was choosing his victims. Like I said, he lived in a remote cabin in the middle of the woods and he loved nature. So when Ted was choosing his Unabomber victims, they always had some connection with nature in their names. He also included things like twigs and sprigs inside the bombs. For example, one of his victims was Percy Wood, who was president of United Airlines, and he was from Lake Forest. The founders of Johnson & Johnson were Robert Wood Johnson and James Wood Johnson. And also some of the locations where the Tylenol was placed was Woodfield Shopping Centre and Elk Grove Village. I mean, yeah, maybe it does come across as a bit of a conspiracy theory, but you can't really deny the links that are possibly there. But like I said, the FBI never really went any further into their investigation into Ted Kaczynski being the Tylenol murderer, so we can assume that they didn't find anything else. There's actually a photo of the police's number one suspect, a man caught on CCTV at the Walgreens where Paula Prince was buying her bottle of Tylenol. Apparently this man was just watching her intently as she bought it. Now this man might have absolutely nothing to do with it whatsoever, but you can understand why the FBI want to talk to him about it. But of course, this was 1982, technology isn't what it is today, and therefore it is crazy blurred. It's really hard to actually work out the facial features of this person. All you can see is that it's a man with a very bushy beard, and both James Lewis and Ted Kaczynski had very bushy beards. There's also another interesting suspect who I don't actually think had anything to do with it, but she's interesting, so we're going to talk about her anyway. Maybe you might think she is a good suspect. It's a woman called Laurie Dann. Now, Laurie was a very disturbed woman. She clearly had a lot of mental health issues that were never really addressed. She murdered one boy, but also tried to injure and kill several others. In May 1988, so like 6 years after the Tylenol murders, Mary prepares some snacks and juice boxes and fills them with diluted arsenic. And then she goes around either mailing or hand delivering these snack packs to sort of acquaintances, people she barely knows, people she used to babysit for, her psychiatrist, her ex-husband, and just leaves them to them. Now she did a really bad job at this because they're leaking all over the place, they don't look very appetizing, so people don't really drink them or eat them. The people that did said they didn't have much because it tasted awful and nobody died, the arsenic was so diluted. A couple of days later, she picks up some children that she used to babysit from a family called the Rush family, and then drives to a nearby elementary school where she tries to detonate a firebomb. And this school is the school that she believes her sister-in-law's daughter goes to, but she actually got it wrong. Luckily, the firebomb only made a small fire, which was quickly discovered by students, and it was put out and nobody was harmed. She then takes the Rush children back to their house where she tries to feed them arsenic-infused milk, but it tastes awful, so they don't drink it. And then she tries to set the house on fire with the children and the mother. I think she tried to trap them down in the basement before setting the house on fire. And then she leaves, but everyone gets out. Like, Laurie is just doing really half-hearted attempts to kill people. She's clearly not in a secure enough mental state to properly think through what she's doing. All she knows is that she wants to cause destruction. She drives to a school called Hubbard Wood Elementary School where she enters with three handguns. She walks into a boy's toilet and shoots at a boy before going into a second grade classroom, lining up all the children in the corner of the room and shooting at them. She only kills one boy but severely injures five others. She later committed suicide after barricading herself in her room so the police couldn't get to her. I mean, she's as good a suspect as any. She clearly had the idea of using poison, diluted arsenic in this case. Is it really out of the ordinary to think that she may have used cyanide years earlier? I mean, it's quite a hallmark of female killers that in general they tend to go towards poison as their murder weapon of choice. But in September of 1982, Laurie had just got married, so you would assume she'd be in quite a happy mental state. And there's actually no evidence to link her whatsoever to the cyanide murders, but she lived in the same area, she used arsenic years later, you can see why people would make the connection. She actually began to really deteriorate after her divorce in 1987, and that's when things got really bad. Even though it was clear she had mental problems from a very young age, I don't think she would have done the cyanide murders. I mean, really, in this case, the murderer could have been absolutely anyone. The police have zero suspects. If you think about it, they really like James Lewis as their suspect, and they looked into him again, I think in 2011, 2012, and they searched his house again, but nothing came of it. They just have nothing. I personally wouldn't be shocked if it was a woman, because like I said, they do tend to gravitate towards poison as their murder weapon of choice, but it's usually always a man. Like I said at the beginning of this video, there were over 200 copycat attacks after the Tylenol murders. I'm not saying 200 people died, but there were at least 200 attempts. And quite a few people did die because of these. Apart from this though, the aftermath of the murders was actually pretty positive. It led to a complete overhaul in how pharmaceutical companies and even the food industry packaged their products. And since then, there hasn't been a major incident like this one. Nowadays, there's even more security during the actual manufacturing process. And of course, nowadays, there's advanced CCTV and there's better ways to track people. So even if people could do this nowadays, I doubt they would do. I think this case is one that's going to go down in history as a cold case. I doubt it's ever going to get solved. I think at this point, the only way that they're ever going to find who did it is possibly a deathbed confession. I mean, in some cases, some serial killing cases, you have DNA, you have things that you could eventually lead to a person. But in this case, all you have is a smudged fingerprint, and that doesn't really mean much. I mean, this was over 35 years ago now. 36 years? I don't know. I can't do maths that quick. Forgive me. So most people's memories of this time will be very blurry, and a lot of people who would have been around who were really dealing with the details of this case are probably a lot older now and no longer working on it. But I would say this is probably in my top 5 cases of ones I would love to see solved in my lifetime. Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode of Mysteries and Histories. If you have a bit of time, I would love for you to go and leave a review wherever you're listening to this podcast and spread the word. It would be much appreciated. I'll see you next week.